Sponsored in part by Eli Lilly and Company. Do you think you might have migraine? Talk to your healthcare professional about your symptoms, the number of days they impact your life, and which treatment options might be best for you. Learn more at thinkmigraine.com. And the American Brain Foundation. For over 30 years, the foundation has worked with researchers to discover better treatment, prevention, and cures for brain diseases and disorders. Imagine life without brain disease. Learn more at AmericanBrainFoundation.org. Rethreaded offers hope and a fresh start to survivors of human trafficking right here in Jacksonville. None of us should be defined by the worst things that happen to us. Learn more about how you can unlock the potential of survivors at Rethreaded.com. And by Neurelis, a leading neuroscience company focused on the development and commercialization of therapeutics for the treatment of epilepsy and other neurologic disorders. The company's unique drug portfolio strives to address unmet needs in patient care. Learn more at Neurelis.com.
Hi, I'm Dr. Joe Servin, a practicing neurologist at Mayo Clinic and professor of healthcare science and policy at Arizona State University. This is What's Health Got to Do with It, which looks at where and how healthcare intersects with your life, helping you get the medical answers you want. Coming up, medical gaslighting, reflections with someone with a rare condition. Then, we continue our special segment on sleep called The Night Shift. But first, have you seen this movie? If you recognize this theme from a classic 1940s film, please let me know by email or X or LinkedIn. We need to talk to you because that's incredible. I'm officially impressed. The movie is Gaslight. It's a psychological thriller starring Ingrid Bergman that was a box office hit when released in 1944. And its time in the limelight could have ended right then and there. However, the ruse employed by its villain gave the work remarkable staying power. It's set in 1880s London. The story plays out in the upper middle class gaslit home of Gregory and Paula Anton. Gregory is intent on making Paula think that she's going insane so that he can have her committed to a mental institution and claim her inheritance. He attempts to convince her that the gaslighting in their house, which the audience can see is flickering, is not really flickering. What her senses tell her is a lie, a sign of her steady descent into madness. Today, the term gaslighting is widely used to describe psychological manipulation, where a person is made to doubt their perception of reality. Medical gaslighting, a term we hear all the time now, occurs when healthcare practitioners dismiss or undermine a patient's symptoms or history, often leading to misdiagnosis or inappropriate testing. Gaslit patients typically reflect a power imbalance and disproportionately affects women, LGBTQ individuals, people of color, and older adults. There's usually a clear power imbalance at play. For women living with rare conditions, it's even worse. Heather is a young woman who struggled for nearly a decade to find medical professionals that would take her symptoms seriously before she finally reached a diagnosis of acute hepatic porphyria, or AHP. This is a debilitating rare genetic disease characterized by excruciating attacks and, for some, chronic and painful symptoms that affects less than 200,000 people. Unfortunately, Heather's not alone in her long journey to find the right diagnosis. Given that AHP is so rare and its symptoms resemble those of more common conditions, misdiagnoses are common and people may wait up to 15 years, 15, to receive an accurate diagnosis, enduring unnecessary treatments and surgeries, such as hysterectomies, along with devastating mental health effects. Joining us now to share her story is Heather. She is a young woman with a rare genetic condition, acute hepatic porphyria. She lives in the Chesapeake, Virginia area, and she prefers that we not use her last name. Heather, I want to thank you for joining us on today's show.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
I want to start off with kind of like the very basic condition. Can you share, if you can, with our listeners, your journey, your story to getting diagnosed with AHP and the challenges that you had to face along the way?
Yeah, I'd love to. So I was in 11th grade. I had just started my junior year in high school and I stayed home. You know, I think it was like the third day into the school year. I thought I had like the flu or something. I was throwing up, had really bad stomach pain. A couple days later, I still wasn't getting any better. So my mom took me to the emergency room. They ran a bunch of different tests. They thought I had like appendicitis possibly. So they were going to admit me and do some additional tests to figure out what it was. So I stayed in that hospital for about a week and they were continuously running different tests. And my mom actually remembered that we do have a family history of porphyria. And so she said, well, why don't you guys test her for this? It kind of aligns with the symptoms.
Sure.
And I think I'm one of the lucky ones because my mom remembers that was part of our family history.
Yes.
And so she brought that up and the doctor refused to do the testing for it because it was so rare. So that was initially how it all started for me. I ended up being there for almost 2 weeks. It was right around September 2001. I had a seizure. Like, it was really bad. I genuinely thought I was going to die. Like, it was just terrible. Right after 9/11 happened, my parents had me transferred to a bigger hospital where there was a specialist there, and he actually did run the tests, and I was confirmed to have porphyria.
So if they would have, so if I get you right, if they would have run the test 2 weeks before, like right at the beginning of the admission or the first hospitalization, you would have been done.
Right. Yep. We would have figured it out very quickly.
Oh my goodness. I brought up the description of medical gaslighting and its roots in a classic movie. How do you think of that term, because I hear it so often. How do you, when you use it, what's your interpretation of that particular term?
It definitely resonated. I would definitely say, like, it's just, you know, somebody or multiple people are trying to convince you of something that's not the case, even when you know, like, in my situation, I know, like, I had a confirmed diagnosis, and we'll get into it more, I'm sure, that even with that diagnosis, doctors were trying to tell me that my symptoms and what I was experiencing were not real, that it was something else was to blame.
Can you, I know you kind of brought up, I heard you say seizure. What were the big symptoms that you had at that time?
So the biggest one was like abdominal pain. I had excruciating abdominal pain. It's not normal, like, most pain is like just intense and like everything like that, but mine was like a burning sensation. And so the best way to like visualize that is somebody had molten hot lava hands and they were like twisting my insides of my stomach. Like, it just was excruciating burning sensation. I was throwing up a lot, really bad headaches. I was very, very tired. Like, I didn't feel like I could sleep enough. And everything on my body just felt like really heavy. My head, my arms, my legs, everything just felt really heavy.
That sounds like a nightmare, if you will.
Yeah, it was bad in the beginning, that's for sure.
So did you, even after you had the diagnosis, did you get dismissals of your symptoms or other people trying to to redirect the diagnosis anytime you had these attacks?
All the time. So the first 2 years after I was diagnosed, mind you, I'm 16 at this point. So I had several people tell me that it was in my head, that I had a bad home life, that I was just trying to escape that. Like, everybody was dismissing my symptoms, and I had to meet with psychologists, psychiatrists, like, and they had to, like, you know, analyze my background and figure out what was going on that I was trying to escape from my life. It wasn't just the disease was causing all of these problems. There was something else.
Heather, can you give me a sense of what were some of the more frustrating or invalidating things that the doctor said to you before you received the diagnosis?
Honestly, I don't remember a lot from that time. Like, sure. I was really sick in the beginning. I just remember, like, my mom really pushing to get me tested for the disease, and them just like, so one of the questions I do remember that he asked her was if she had been tested. And so she hadn't been, but she hasn't ever had any symptoms. And he said, well, if she hasn't been tested and she doesn't have any symptoms, then there's no way that I would have it. And so I just felt like that was like,
wow,
like that's just not accurate. So I was really frustrated that he was so dismissive of having a family history, and still, like, because it's so rare and she hadn't been tested, that that's the reason that he wouldn't run the test.
I'm still processing that someone would actually say that, because in this day and age, you run the test just to be safe. It's amazing what still happens. You know, Heather, why do you think women, particularly those with a rare condition like with what you have, and we'll talk about porphyria in a moment, why do you think they experience gaslighting? I mean, I know you're not an expert in this area, but you experience this. Why do you think they are more prone to receive it after having had it done to you?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think part of it is women are more dismissed in general, like as far as pain or, you know, something is actually wrong with us. I think in general, we tend to be dismissed more often than men do. I think part of that is, you know, porphyria especially, or any rare disease, sometimes you don't even look sick. And so I've heard that a lot as well. Like, I didn't look sick, so there's no way that I could be as sick as I actually was. So I think that's part of it too, is, you know, women are, I think personally, a little bit better at, you know, hiding when we're in pain or putting on a smile and, you know, faking it through whatever we're dealing with, because most of us can just do that fine. Whereas, you know, no offense, I think men are a little bit more babies when it comes to that stuff.
No offense taken. Fair enough. Heather, did you pursue a career in health, or did you go a very different route?
Initially, I did want to pursue a career in the health industry. I really, you know, I had a plan for my life. In 11th grade, I had enrolled in a nursing program that I would graduate high school with my nursing certificate. And so my plan was I was going to work as a nurse while I was going to college. And I, you know, I had all of this planned out. Of course, when I got sick, all of that changed. Like, I had to drop the nursing class. Like, I, you know, couldn't pursue what I had wanted to. And then once I realized like how kind of broken the healthcare system is, I really, you know, I want to do more from like a patient advocacy side. And so I tried to get into that more. And unfortunately, I just could not get into that community because they said I didn't have enough work history, which just seemed so crazy to me because guess what? My resume didn't reflect all the patient advocacy work that I had done. I had over, you know, 10 years of being a patient and really advocating for myself. So that was extremely frustrating. So I ended up, now I do financial planning. So I still get to help people.
Sure,
it's just a little bit of a different way.
I'm still amazed at that element. If you're a patient and you had to struggle with it, that's pretty good work experience from my standpoint. To all of our listeners out there, you're listening to What's Health Got to Do with It on WJCT News 89.9. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, and if you're just joining us, we're talking about medical gaslighting, and we want to hear from you. If you have an idea for future shows, tag me on X or LinkedIn at JServin. Heather, when you finally got the diagnosis, was that the person that you stayed with for your healthcare needs regarding the porphyria?
It wasn't. So he actually he was a specialist at the hospital that I went to, which was about 3 hours from my house at the time,
right,
where I grew up. He ended up moving to Texas or something, I think. And I was from like really far upstate New York, like almost Canada area. So we tried to meet with local doctors to where we lived, and all the doctors said they were just uncomfortable treating me. They didn't know enough about the disease. So I ended up going to a bigger university hospital, which was about 3 hours from where I lived. And so that's where every time I had an attack or something, we would drive that 3 hours to that hospital. That team ended up taking care of me for the next 2 years until I graduated high school. I really had to push to advocate for myself to get a different treatment plan put in place. They were kind of just going to let me keep experiencing attacks that were that frequent. And so I really pushed to get that, like, let's try this. Can we try this? So that really helped improve my health a lot. Because I ended up doing weekly infusions, and that changed from, you know, at least 1 to 2 attacks a month to I had, you know, maybe a couple a year at that point.
Heather, how are you now?
So I actually had a liver transplant a couple years ago. It's been about 9 years this October. And since then, I have not had any symptoms moving forward. So I feel great now, but I had to go through a lot to get that transplant. So
that is huge. Can you, for our listeners out there, let's talk a little bit about the condition. You have this diagnosis, a rare genetic condition, acute hepatic porphyria. I'm familiar with it. I've actually published on it, on the neurologic side on it. Can you tell us, as best you can, a little bit about the condition?
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, it's super rare. It affects every individual person a little bit differently, which is kind of what makes it so hard to diagnose and treat. Everybody's got it a little bit different. I kind of joked that I was a special type of rare and that I had a rare form of a rare disease where I had symptoms all the time. So in my situation, I always had pain. There wasn't a point in time where the pain went away. And in some people, they, you know, have an attack, they have acute pain, you know, they have some of the symptoms, and then that will go away. I had issues all the time. So it never really went away. My quality of life was really, really poor. Pain is the biggest thing. I was very sensitive to lights, sounds, smells. You know, I really didn't want to be bombarded by much of that stuff. So I joked that I wanted to be in like a quiet, dark room. And then like throwing up, the nausea, like stuff like that. It really takes a toll on your body and your mental health status. Like, it's very difficult to deal with that stuff long term. But I will say, anybody out there that is dealing with something like that, you gotta stay positive and you just gotta keep being an advocate for yourself.
Let me ask, what kind of treatments did you get? I know you mentioned liver transplant, which I imagine was an end point, but what kind of treatments did you get for management of this porphyria, which I might add has to do with literally a genetic problem where, in terms of metabolism of a particular enzyme and all?
Yep. So the treatments are going to be different for every person, because like I said, everybody's situation is a little bit different. So I don't want to talk about specific treatments because I don't want like people to take that as my advice of what they should be doing.
Sure.
They really need to talk to their healthcare professionals to develop that plan.
What kind of healthcare professional was it? What specialist did you have to go see? What kind of specialist?
It can be anywhere from a primary care doctor to a hematologist to a liver specialist. Like, I've seen all of those. And I would say what's more important than the type of doctor is the relationship you have with that person. I really struggled finding a doctor that wanted to come alongside me and fight with me. They mostly just accepted, okay, well, this is good enough, and we're just going to keep doing what we're doing for you. And it was not good enough. I really was struggling. And without finding somebody that was willing to, you know, come alongside me and fight beside me to make my health situation better, I would have kept changing doctors until I found that person. So that's not always possible for everybody, and I understand that. But if you find a doctor, and maybe you have to try a couple of different ones, that really makes a difference in the long run.
Heather, what resources or organizations were most helpful to you during your journey, your time, your search for answers?
So I will say I was diagnosed over 20 years ago. So the amount of information that's available now compared to when I first was diagnosed is night and day different. There's the American Porphyria Foundation, there's pinpointahp.com. Those are the two biggest resources that are out there that are available now. And there's even resources out there about how to talk to your doctor when you are officially diagnosed and like what, you know, what options you have to put a plan in place for your health. When I was first diagnosed, none of that stuff was out there. So I know we still have a long way to go for, you know, porphyria, especially AHP, but all rare diseases. But I will say, like, there is a lot of resources out there now.
What advice would you want to give our listeners or others who feel they're just not being heard by their doctors? What do you want to tell them?
That you are the only person that's going to advocate for your health. You have to keep pushing. If you're running into a wall, like I said, if you can get a new doctor, do it. I've gone through many doctors before I found somebody who was willing to really listen to me. And you have to be willing to explain with as vivid of imagery as you can of what your symptoms are truly like. Because if you just say, I'm in pain, they're going to be like, okay, you're in pain. But if you say, I have molten hot hands twisting my insides, like give them something that's going to help them to truly understand what you're going through, I think you're more successful in getting somebody to come alongside and fight with you.
How has your experience with all of this shaped your view of the healthcare system?
Oh gosh, that's so hard. So I was really discouraged with the healthcare system in general. There was several times where I was declined treatments. I was declined that they were going to pay for stuff. When I got my liver transplant approved by doctors, my healthcare declined paying for it. I appealed it, they declined paying for it again. So our healthcare system is very frustrating, not just the health insurance, but doctors as well. So like I said before, you just have to keep being an advocate for yourself and really keep pushing, you know, that envelope. I ended up not just changing, you know, I got my liver transplant approved, but I didn't just do that. They actually told me that they changed the law to that person. Nobody else is going to have to get that appeal or go through that appeal process again in the future. They actually changed that law. So you can make changes. You just have to be very stubborn and like really advocate for yourself because you can push through. And I know with a rare disease, like that sucks. I get that. You are the only one that's going to do it. Nobody else is going to stand up and fight for you. So you have to just do it yourself.
Heather, I want to thank you so much for sharing your story and your experiences with us. I'm so sorry you had to go through that, but I am so delighted that you are doing well now and just appreciative that you're able to share this story with great insight for all of us to benefit from. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you again for having me. It was awesome to be here.
We've been talking to Heather. She is someone who has had to endure medical gaslighting. She has a rare genetic condition, acute hepatic porphyria. She's told us her story. She's gotten a diagnosis. She's gotten the treatment. And we're just happy that she's doing so well. And up next, our weekly health headlines. Then, the night shift. And we'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Dr. Joe Servant, a practicing neurologist and professor of healthcare administration and policy. This is What's Health Got to Do with It? And these are your weekly health headlines. ALS is a devastating neurological disease affecting around 30,000 Americans, with most living only 2 to 5 years post-diagnosis. Despite many clinical trials, effective treatments remain elusive. In 2022, Congress allocated $1 million for a study by the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine to transform ALS into a manageable condition within a decade. The report recommends improving access to high-quality care, eliminating insurance barriers, expanding genetic testing, and enhancing caregiver support. However, critics argue that its generic recommendations, like developing better biomarkers, lack a robust research and development strategy and won't end ALS deaths by 2035. Meanwhile, the CDC recommends new COVID-19 vaccines for everyone aged 6 months and older amid rising summer infections. These updated vaccines target recent variants and provide incremental immunity boosts. The CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices emphasizes the importance of staying updated with vaccinations to prevent severe illness and hospitalizations. In other health news, doctors are prescribing antibiotics to most children and teens with pink eye despite guidelines advising against it. A study found that more than two-thirds of children with pink eye received unnecessary antibiotic prescriptions, which are ineffective against viral infections, the most common cause of pink eye. Additionally, a New York Times investigation revealed that at least a dozen Navy SEALs have died by suicide in the last decade, with researchers finding blast damage in their brains. A Harvard study also found altered brain structures in nearly all scanned career special operators, linking blast exposure to compromised brain function and health, prompting the Navy to limit blast exposure and participate in medical research. Those are your weekly health headlines. Today, we continue our special segment on sleep that we're calling The Night Shift. In today's segment, we look at a topic that often gets missed in our conversations regarding sleep. Does sleep affect all people the same way? Are there differences in sleep issues among diverse populations? And if there are, what do we do about it? Joining us to explore this provocative issue is Dr. Pablo Castillo. He is a professor of neurology, director of the Sleep Fellowship at Mayo Clinic in Florida, and he joins us now. Dr. Castillo, welcome to our program.
Thank you, Jimmy. It's great to be here.
So good to have you. So let's start off with this question. How does our understanding of sleep differ across cultures? I guess, put another way, does culture or ethnicity affect people's sleep?
Absolutely. Let me start by just mentioning something that affects everybody in terms of benefits. Sleep benefits are numerous, and the scientific understanding of this are expanding every year. That includes quality of life, physical and psychological well-being, cognitive learning, and even public safety. Sleep is critical to every aspect of our health, and it's a non-negotiable biologic life support system. And I would dare to say, and I agree with some authors, calling sleep actually it's pretty serious to say, but if they consider a low grade, if you remain alert without having the recovery of sleep, alertness itself is taxing to the brain.
Right.
The state of alertness is demanding, and authors call it low grade brain damage if you stay prolongedly awake without having the sleep recovery. And in terms of your question, how diverse, how affects different communities and perceptions, there is a well-studied difference. For example, you know, Black and Hispanic individuals in many epidemiologic studies tend to show poorer sleep quality, continuity, shorter sleep duration, and greater risk of sleep apnea than white individuals. Huh. And, you know, I like to quote, not a scientist, but a sociologist, which is like almost 20 years ago, he described sleep as a marker. He said, when we sleep, where we sleep, and with whom we sleep is an important marker of social status, privilege, and prevailing power relations. That was Simon Williams.
Interesting.
And so that is very important, because my passion is the biology of sleep, but this biological process occurs in a social and environmental context.
Now, let me ask you this. So I ask about diverse communities. What about just economic factors? How does, you know, where you sit in terms of how the money you make or the demographic group that you belong to, does that impact sleep quality or duration? And if it does, what can we do about that?
Absolutely, it does. You know, minorities, low-income families, often confront higher level of pollution, living near a highway, for example, noise, a noisy neighborhood, crime, allergens. All of those, so location, geographic location, actually is associated with poor sleep quality. And that it also implies access to workplace, you know, depending where you live. Night shift work, for example. African Americans are more prone to have jobs that require shift work. And so we also know that African Americans are very sensitive to jet lag. From studies of circadian rhythm, we know that African Americans have shorter circadian periods, meaning they are more at risk of developing the consequences of night shift work, which includes, you know, health safety problems, increased risk of hypertension, metabolic syndrome, and even cancer. So that has an impact on these low-income communities who are more prone to do night shift work.
Now, let me ask you this. Given that now I'm hearing that, you know, there is some aspects of sleep that are going to vary amongst socioeconomic groups, diverse populations. Can you kind of tell me and all our listeners, what are some common misconceptions about sleep that maybe contributes to these differences or disparities when it comes to sleep health?
Absolutely. There are a few that are very common in my practice. And one of them is that needing a little sleep is a marker of success. Some people say, right. I will sleep when I'm dead.
Right.
And I argue that,
I've heard that.
by sleeping well, you may actually delay your funeral. That's one misconception. The other misconception is how long you sleep is all that matters. And that's absolutely wrong, because the timing of sleep, in addition to quality and duration, are the three major factors to really get the sleep you need. The other one is that people believe that napping makes up for lack of nighttime sleep. And that's also a misconception, because we know that a nap will not provide you with the normal physiologic progression of sleep architecture that nighttime sleep gives you.
I see.
And finally, there are two more that I hear. Another one is, I can sleep drinking all the coffee I need and it doesn't affect me. That's a very common one. And so what I tell people is, yes, some people are sensitive and caffeine can delay sleep onset. But the issue with caffeine is not that it won't let you fall asleep. It's actually that it will rob you from REM sleep, more so than slow wave sleep. And so that is the issue with caffeine. And then you will feel the effects of having that altered sleep architecture with a reduction in REM sleep. And that in turn will make you need more caffeine the next day to mitigate that feeling. So it's like a vicious cycle. And finally, the last one is that some people believe that sleeping doesn't help them with weight loss. So sometimes many people get up early in the morning to go to the gym, lose a lot of the REM sleep, and then go to work. I remind them that you burn about 50 calories per hour during sleep, which is about 400 to 500 calories per night, by not moving and letting the brain what it needs to do in just your circadian rhythm. Your liver will go into gluconeogenesis to maintain your glucose, and even though you're not exercising, you are actually burning calories.
I that part has now made me very delighted. And imagine our listeners that maybe we should get that extra sleep. Let me ask you a question that seems to come up a lot these days, and that has to do with systemic inequalities and discrimination and its impact on health. What do we know about these injustices, discrimination to certain communities, as to how it impacts sleep patterns and quality? What do we know?
Well, this is extremely important, and it's a passion of mine. It touched me deeply, because I'm an immigrant, and there is an issue about immigrating to this country and changing the sleep. I don't know, we will have time to talk about that. But the question for this is, when do these disparities in sleep loss begin? It begins at some point. And so there are stories showing that this actually starts in childhood. You know, they're perpetuating behaviors but if maintained into adulthood, will maintain the state of poverty. It's kind of shocking, but let me just elaborate. The study is showing, for example, that short sleep duration in a child increases the risk of childhood obesity. That's pretty established. Mm. And if you have childhood obesity, that's a setup for adult obesity as well. So that alone is a modifiable risk factor for obesity by fighting short sleep duration in children. Now, there's a study published a few years ago showing the benefits of a bedtime routine in young children, beyond just sleep, but actually developing and academic success. So you can set a child on a trajectory to have lower behavioral health and academic outcome if you are lacking these sleep routines that favor sleep. Now, that has child factors, family factors, and contextual factors. A bedtime routine basically is a consistent, predictable set of activities before light out for the child. And that may mean feeding, hygiene, bath, teeth, putting pajamas, reading books, lullabies. All of that has been shown, that structure is highly beneficial. Now, we're going somewhere with this, because that kind of family structure is associated with using bedtime routines, usually includes a father. When you have a father, which it has to be an involved father, of course, the family is more likely to report having bedtime routines. Single mother families, working mothers, are least likely to engage in regular bedtime routines. And that's logical, because if you have two jobs, and you cannot make it home on time, you're exhausted literally, you will not be able to do that. And it that promotes poor sleep habits in the child and set them in this trajectory to have poor academic outcomes, exposure to television, you know, a series of behavioral factors that at night can sabotage a child's sleep. And sleep is important for adults, but for children, it is critical because we're talking about development.
Understood. And to all of our listeners out there, you're listening to What's Health Got to Do with It on WJCT News 89.9. And if you're just joining us, we are talking about sleep or the night shift. And if you have ideas for future shows, tag me on X or LinkedIn at Jay Servin. Dr. Castillo, let me kind of switch to a slightly different topic about sleep, and one that we don't talk about enough, but how does sleep deprivation, the lack of sleep, affect your immune system or your ability to fight off an infection or illness?
Yes, there's no question that sleep is critical for immune system physiology. In vitro studies show that sleep loss, meaning 4 hours or less, reduces natural killer cell activity, okay, compared to individuals who have a full night's sleep. And the reduction is about, it's massive, it's like 75%. Now, but more than the in vitro, there are studies showing that poor sleep quality is increased susceptibility to have infectious disease. In children who sleep less than the recommended hours, they are increased otitis media, bacterial, and viral illnesses. Now, in adults, there was a study that showed a very elegant study. They studied antibody response to hepatitis B. This was published in 2012, and showed that there is a reduction in clinical protection if you have short sleep duration in response to bivalent antibody responses. Another study following up that showed that if you increase sleep after you are vaccinated against hepatitis A, that boosts immunological memory. And in last year, we published here, our sleep fellow first author a paper of 24,000 patients. We found that if you have insomnia, a circadian rhythm, or inadequate sleep, your response to COVID-19 vaccination was poor with increased breakthrough infections in vaccinated patients. So it looks like the central nervous system, just like the CNS, the immune system, take advantage of that state of offline condition during sleep to foster immunologic memory.
That is huge. And I have to admit, I never have had anyone say, get a good night's rest after your vaccine so it can work better. But wow, that's fascinating. Let me ask one that I think to me seems more logical that there's the connection, but can you tell us what role does sleep play in regulating stress? Everyone is so stressed. So what role does sleep play in helping us manage that stress?
Yes, this is a very important topic because in terms of practicality affecting minorities and stress, I will put this in here. Consider a law enforcement officer who irrationally reacts to a civilian who committed a mild infraction because law enforcement officer is sleep deprived, a nurse or a doctor who responds without care to a patient asking a question, or a boss who lashes out to a well-meaning employee. This has nothing to do with it mean, but everything to do with lack of sleep. Sleep loss amplifies emotional reactivity. And there are studies in functional MRI showing that the amygdala becomes more reactive to negative emotion under sleep loss, just similar to condition like suicide. So lack of sleep will increase negative mood state, anxiety, depression, even suicide ideas. But more importantly, society-wise, is that it impairs your accurate recognition and expression of emotion in others. So the lack of empathy that sleep loss produces is actually problematic because that will increase social withdrawal, social isolation. And if you think about that, that's not going to help in the workplace. We have people responding to phone calls from patients, they're sleep deprived, their empathy is going to be impaired, and it's going to be hard to provide good customer care. More than that, if you are sleep deprived and have this lack of recognition of emotions in others, that's actually contagious. And so it's showing that even to a well-rested people, they can actually get involved in that type of behavior. So it seems to me that for productivity, it's a terrible idea to have a bunch of sleep deprived employees.
No, it makes such perfect sense the way you're describing it. So, like, as we kind of get into last few minutes of our conversation, I want to ask, like, do you cite any particular cultural or community-specific practices related to sleep that promotes better sleep? Is there any examples that you want to highlight for us?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question, because, yes, there is one. I'm from Ecuador, which is the middle of the world. I'm on the equator line,
right,
where sunset always happens, never changes, around 6:30 throughout the year. So it's a very good place to have a stable circadian rhythm. And that's why we have one of the largest biodiversities in the world. The animals don't need to migrate too much because the environment doesn't change much. And the light onset and sunset is the same throughout the year. And we found that this population, when we try to study insomnia, it just doesn't work. I'm talking about rural communities, not city.
Right.
City is just the same as other countries, because they lack this artificial light exposure. So they tend to be, they go to bed early and they rise early. So that's a perfectly thin circadian chronotype that we try to emulate here. Although you have the changes in clock, which is daylight savings time, which sabotages that normal circadian alignment with sunset and sunrise. And it creates a lot of problems. That's a population that I consider an example in terms of circadian health.
Oh, interesting. Now, I'm wondering if you could offer us all practical tips for improving our sleep that are accessible and applicable to everybody, regardless of what background or community you belong to. What are some of those tips that you can offer us?
I will say that you have to remember that the three aspects to get the well short moment that you need is sleep duration. Make sure you know your sleep duration, which is genetically determined, just like your height. So the 8 hours that we recommend may not apply to a short sleeper who only needs 6, or a long sleeper who needs 9, but just you have to know what kind of sleep duration is yours. Then the other one is your sleep quality, the sleep environment. And finally, the timing of sleep. Do not believe that a nap is going to compensate for lack of sleep at nighttime. You need that normal physiologic stage 1, 2, 3 REM cycling that occurs during the nighttime sleep, because it's linked to hormonal profiles as well. That is the deep sleep promotion that nighttime offers you that a daytime nap will not give you. No, sometimes it's necessary, but I'm talking about long-term. Long-term use of napping, prolonged napping during the day may not be a great idea. Finally, have respect for caffeine. Caffeine has a mechanism of action. It blocks adenosine receptors. It has a lethal dose, and it has a rebound effect. So it meets all criteria for a medication. So I tell my patients to be very judicious about the use of caffeine. Because of the long half-life, I recommend people not to drink caffeine at least 6 hours before their bedtime.
6 hours before bedtime.
Yes.
Well, okay, I'm going to have to remember that one. Dr. Castillo, I want to thank you so much. You have given us actually a lot to think about from everything that you've kind of shared with us. These insights are terrific, and we just really thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Dr. Seidman. It was a pleasure.
We've been talking to Dr. Pablo Castillo. He's a professor of neurology, a practicing sleep medicine specialist, and program director for the Sleep Medicine Fellowship at Mayo Clinic in Florida. Well, that's our program for today. We hope you've enjoyed our show. If you missed anything, you can listen to the full episode at WJCT.org and on your favorite podcast app. Thanks to all of our guests. Our executive producer is David Luckin. Stacey Bennett is our producer. Brady Corum is our director. Jamie Vallee is our associate producer. On next week's program, we talk to former NIH director Dr. Francis Collins about the Sound Health Initiative. If you have questions about this or any topic, let us know by calling us at 904-358-6362, email us at health@wjct.org, or tag me on X or LinkedIn at Jay Servin. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, and you're listening to What's Health Got to Do With It on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville. Thank you for listening, and stay in touch. Gonna be some sweet songs coming down on the night shift. I bet you're singing proud. Oh, I bet you're full of crime. Gonna be a long night. It's gonna be alright on the night shift. You found another home. I know you're not alone on the night shift. Jackie, hey, what you doing now? It seems like yesterday when we were working out. Jackie, you set the world on fire. You came and gifted us. Your love, it lifted us higher and higher. Keep it up, and we'll be there at your side.
Sponsored in part by Eli Lilly and Company. Is migraine impacting your life or daily activities 4 or more days per month? If so, ask your healthcare professional if you are a candidate for migraine prevention treatments and which ones might be best for you. Learn more at thinkmigraine.com. The American Brain Foundation. For over 30 years, the foundation has worked with researchers to discover better treatment, prevention, and cures for brain diseases and disorders. Imagine life without brain disease. Learn more at AmericanBrainFoundation.org. And ReThreaded restores choice and breaks the cycle of generational trauma for survivors of human trafficking in Jacksonville, Florida, through business. You can help. Learn more about ReThreaded survivor-created goods at the storefront or ReThreaded.com/shop.